Hello and welcome to the OnFit podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. This is our second Ahead of the European Central Bank series, and on this week's episode, we talk about the December ECB monetary policy decision. I'm joined by Francesco Papadia, Senior Fellow at Bruegel and former Director General of Market Operations at the European Central Bank, and Alexandra Petrov, Assistant Vice President, Policy and Research, Official Institutions Group at State Street Global Advisors. Welcome.
This week we'll be looking at the big decisions happening next week in light of the ECB decision. We can expect some significant market reaction. The stakes are very high as we expect the ECB to formally end QE, outline their reinvestment strategy, provide growth aspects and forecasts on inflation, particularly at a time when Europe's economy has slowed. One of the main points focus surrounding the reinvestment strategy and the issue of the capital key and whether the ECB will drop its commitment to reinvest into the same country where the bonds were originally bought. The question is, will the ECB stick to its plan to end net asset purchases, and what are the considerations they need to account for when deciding on the bond buying criteria? Francesco, if I go first to you, what are your views here?
Well, I have a little doubt that the ECB will stop its net investment. They have said that they will do it, and nothing much has changed to make them change their mind. Of course, as you said, there is some evidence of a slowing down of the euro area economy, but it's much too early to say whether this is just a respite from the higher than potential growth that used to be in the previous quarters, or is there something more serious? And it's also too early to say whether we are seeing a new fracture in the euro area between the core and the periphery. And unless this, the ECB was convinced that these two things were coming, and I don't see that they are convinced, they will not change their mind. They will stop for their program of net asset purchases.
I see. Alex, so obviously you mentioned one of the key aspects is the reinvestment strategy and the issues of the capital key. What are the things at stake here?
Sure. So one of the only things which have changed sort of over the course of the existing program is that they did some minor tweaks of the balance between the supranational and agency bonds and government bonds, but it wasn't significant in the overall terms. So I think the capital key is quite a strong part of the ECB's institutional framework, and you know, an explicit deviation from this in whatever form would sort of go quite, I think, strongly against the ECB's culture. It's also the case that at least in theory, any country-specific interventions have to be conducted within the framework of programs like the OMT. So I think it's very hard for me to imagine a scenario where such a deviation would happen, because there would have to be some basically change in institutional structure to allow that to happen. And I think it's very hard to find a group to vote for them to vote for such a decision. So I also agree that it's very unlikely, at least within the context of the main asset purchase program.
If I may add something to this, if I was a journalist attending the press conference of the president of the ECB, I would ask him about reinvestment. And reinvestment, how will it be calibrated? Because I see two possibilities, and it's not clear in my mind which one the ECB would follow. The first possibility is that they would apply the new capital key that, as you know, gives more weight to Germany, the Netherlands, less weight to Italy and some other peripheral countries. Or that they would just buy, reinvest to what is maturing. So if an Italian bond is maturing, they would invest in that. If a German bond is maturing, they would invest in that, which would mean really using the old capital key that was the one that led the purchases in the first place. And I don't think that this would make a huge difference, but I think it would make a difference with respect to the spread and things like that. So I would be curious to understand from Draghi whether reinvestment means just you buy what is maturing or you buy according to the new capital key.
Thank you for that. Alex, is there a preference from markets as to which option of the ones outlined just now by Francesco would go forward, or what are the implications of both of markets here?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that ECB has always allowed, they stick to the capital key on a certain horizon, so there are obviously some short-term deviations. And I'm not sure if the differences in the capital keys are very high on the radar on the market participants. The specific bond traders would probably follow these developments, but I think the markets are more interested in the broad direction of the policy. I think one important consideration I wanted to allude to is that the original asset purchase program was conducted broadly on a maturity neutral basis. So the average maturity of ECB's holdings are not significantly different from what is outstanding. I've come across some discussions among bond analysts of whether that could change and whether ECB could do something like the Operation Twist, which the Fed did. But at the same time, I'm not sure ECB has expressed any concerns about the shape of the yield curve. So I would also not see where such an action would come from. So one, but probably in theory, it's important to look both at the distribution across countries and the capital key, and at what maturity would the reinvestment happen, whether if a 10-year bond matures, whether they would buy a 10-year bond or whether they would change that. So I think it's also worth considering from this point of view and which parts of the curve it will affect more than the others.
A little footnote here as well. Even if, as I do believe, and I think that this is in line with what Justin said, that they will do no kind of operation twist, there would be some maturity increase if they buy bonds according to the original maturity. So if they now buy a maturing 10-year bond, there will be an increase in the average maturity of the portfolio because you are substituting a maturing bond with a 10-year bond. So I think that in any case, there will be some, but it will be more of a passive nature rather than any active bending of the purchases towards higher, longer maturities.
Yes, and I think if I may add, it's worth remembering that a number of European governments took the opportunity of low interest rates to actually extend the average maturity of their outstanding debt. So from the original program, that differed as well. So I think what is fair to say is that this maturity aspect may actually be at least as important as the capital key aspect, especially for individual bond trades and short-term movements of the market.
Great. Thank you both for that. Francesco, looking at these big decisions that need to be taken, what would you say are some of the risks that could be looming if the ECB does decide to change its capital key?
Well, I think we agreed that this is unlikely to happen. I think it has been mentioned that the capital key is a strong constraint. I mean, everything that the ECB has done that had to be distributed among national central banks, among participating countries, has been done through the capital key with minimal deviations in order not to get mad to necessarily buy that small amount of Maltese or Estonian bonds. But basically, this is a strong constraint. So I don't think, I don't think that there will be a change there. If there was a change, well, then there could be some repercussions basically on the difference between yields in peripheral and core countries, with one important additional qualification that the peripheral countries are now much more differentiated and much less homogeneous than they were, because basically Italy put it in a special, not a favorable position. I mean, if you listen to what Spanish authorities say, basically you could interpret it as that we are not Italian. And of course, the same can be said of the Portuguese. So there is a differentiation that has emerged now within the peripheral countries, with Italy putting itself on one side and the others, Greece is of course always a special case, putting themselves on another side of the market. So if there was a change in the capital key, I think that you would see most of the effect on Italy.
Thank you very much. Alex, what are the other aspects that you would expect to hear, or what are the things you're looking out to hear from next week's decision when it comes down to some of the issues of surrounding inflation and growth assessments for the European economy?
It will be interesting to see in the formal statements following the decision the, if you like, the relative weight of the considerations around inflation and about the overall dynamics of the European economy because of the recent slight quarterly slowdown. I guess because the mandate of the ECB is very much around inflation, but of course in reality policymakers look at the economic dynamic to a great degree. So I think whenever they allude to any future path of interest rates, it would be interesting to see see what role does the recent slowdown and sort of the economic considerations play versus the simple question of where the inflation is relative to the target. So I think we would be looking for any forward-looking comments in the ECB decisions and sort of anything which can be inferred from it about 2019 and 2020.
Francesco, what about from your side? When do you think we can expect the ECB to be able to raise interest rates? Do you think that is something that could happen before Mario Draghi leaves next October?
Well, I think the most likely date is the third quarter of 2019, so just straddling over Draghi's departure. But I think that you have to think of the first rate increase as a kind of homeostatic mechanism. So the ECB will calibrate this first increase depending on what happens to inflation, basically, which is, of course, connected to activity. If inflation is moving more decidedly toward 2%, they would feel more confident to increase rates. If that is less the case, then they would wait a while longer. But in any case, I think that more important than the exact time when they will increase rates, which in any case, I think it would not be the ordinary 25 basis points. It's likely to be lesser than that. It's which kind of message they would send about what would happen after this first increase, because, you know, it's very hard to see the mechanical effect of 10, 15, even 25 basis points on the economy. What is important is what happens after that. So which message the ECB will give about further changes in interest rates. And for that, I think you would have to wait. I don't think that Draghi would be in any way ready this time to say either when the first rate will increase and even less what would follow that. Again, homeostatic, one-to-one to inflation expectations.
Could you argue in a way that this is a dangerous time to withdraw support from the economy? We have the horizon is darkening, issues with Italy, we pointed out. Obviously, the developments we have with the Fed rates rise expected for next year. How would you take that on, Alex?
Yes, well, I mean, we have to keep in mind that the ECB has to operate on the basis of assessing the Eurozone economy as a whole, because given the structure of the monetary union, Italy is just one component of it. I mean, it's quite an interesting paradox in some sense, because from a cyclical point of view, it's probably not the time to have a lot of extraordinary monetary stimulus, and especially in core, all the short-term indicators of the labor market and economic performance are not consistent with extraordinary stimulus. At the same time, we are all aware of the problems you mentioned in Italy and more broadly. So I think this just underlines the challenges of a monetary union. I think at the same time, it's worth saying that the negative interest rate, not just interest rate level, it's policy in itself, and there could be some considerations around when that could be removed, potentially because of the certain side effect it has. So I think it's, you know, on the one hand, the ECB would want to keep the policy very accommodative, but I think this more extraordinary elements of QE and others is something which will be less consistent with the economic cycle. So from the cyclical perspective, I see that it's probably harder to justify, although the timing of any withdrawal has to be very carefully managed.
If I can add something on Italy, I think that the influence of what is happening in Italy on ECB monetary policy will be very, very low. Would be very, very low because of two reasons. First, I don't see that the governing council would be in any way ready to move or calibrate its policy because of what is happening in Italy. What is happening in Italy basically is a government that is insurrecting against the fiscal rules at EU level. And I don't see that the governing council wants in any way to condone this kind of behavior. And then there is a more economic kind of reason. The action of the central bank cannot undo what a government does on its fiscal policy. I mean, the tool is just inappropriate to deal with the problem. So I don't think that unless Italy has consequences for the rest of the euro area, I don't see that the ECB would move or change, adapt its policy depending on what is happening in Italy.
If I may, I just wanted to pick up on the point of the fiscal versus monetary policy, which is, of course, in case of the Eurozone, is conducted by a different number of entities. But I think arguably one of the issues with the asset purchase program of the ECB is that it has come quite late and it has coincided with the fiscal retrenchment, unlike the, for example, the US QE, where at least the QE1 and QE2 coincided with the fiscal stimulus. So I think in that sense, the relative timing of the two was very different anyway. And so it's unlikely that the ECB would suddenly start trying to coordinate their decision with fiscal policies of member states if it hadn't done so for the purposes of the previous round of QE.
If we look at the EU budget scenario situation with Italy, the latest signals that we have had from Rome earlier this week seem to have indicated the Italian government is willing to compromise and make some minor amendments. Obviously, there's still a great amount of tension along the Brussels-Rome line, but as well as between the coalition partners themselves, Five Star Movement and League. In a way, both are too big. They don't want to make too much of a compromise to Brussels, as it could risk upsetting their own supporters. The EU has been very tough in its stance. To what extent the EU's unprecedented move in a way to potentially initiate a disciplinary process and levy fines on Rome, to what extent would the EU be actually in a position to start doing that, Francesco?
I think that there are a few elements to be taken into account here. The first one is that with the two contenders, I see the position of the EU Commission, if you wish, much stronger than that of the Italian government. And let me explain this. On the side of the EU Commission, you have two very strong factors. First, I think they are right on the economics, and the policy of the Italian government is just wrong from an economic point of view. And the second point is that they have the full support of every other member of the euro area. So these are two strong elements for the EU Commission. What is the only strong element for the Italian government is the support that they have in the country, which of course is very important. I mean, they won the elections very clearly. They have, according to opinion polls, a very strong support in the country. But you wonder how long this can last if in the economy, as it seems, just shows that the recipe that the government is following is wrong. The other factor that I would take into account here is that the room for a compromise is difficult to find. Both sides are trying to find it, but before the 2.4 becomes something that is acceptable to the European Commission, it's difficult for the two parties, Lega and Cinque Stelle, to accept. So, on one hand, I see a weak position of the Italian government. On the other hand, I see that a compromise is not easy to find. So I'm not sure I see clearly what could be the outcome of this game between these two actors.
Alex, are there any potential risks or specific areas of concern that you have in this outlook?
Well, I think it's ultimately, I think, more of a political story than a fiscal story, because the amount we're talking about, I mean, in the context of the last 5 years of the history of the Eurozone, they are not that great. There are member states which have been running much more significant deficits and essentially could find compromises on that. So I think on the one hand, it is a little bit disingenuous to say that Italy is being fiscally irresponsible on some extraordinary level. At the same time, we also know that the fiscal expansion does not necessarily come with any kind of longer-term plan attached to it, because it's not as, for example, Italy is undertaking some particularly effective public investment program or doing something which would theoretically boost long-term productivity and maybe combine it with structural reforms. So it is almost a deliberately provocative move on Italy's part as well. I think it is worth saying, however, in the context of the story, that most of the Italian fiscal problems have originated quite far back. They stem from the high deficit levels in the 60s and 70s. Italy has been running primary surpluses in most years in the kind of modern Eurozone era. And the Italian taxpayers of today are mostly paying off the debt of their sort of fathers and grandfathers. So I think on the one hand, it is clear that to some extent you could say that the Italian government is playing with fire and doesn't have a good medium or long-term plan of how they're going to handle the situation. At the same time, it is important to recognize the political reality obviously have Italy and the economic and political reasons why this government came to power in the first place. So I think it could be worrying if the European side would stick to the rules for its own sake and sort of be a little bit too mechanical about this action. But at the same time, it's clear that I think both sides have to give way, because otherwise I think it sets quite a bad precedent, and the EU fiscal framework has to have some credibility behind it. And if no action is taken when something like this happens, it means that the framework is not really working. So I think to some extent, both sides have to make sure that this framework is seen to work. But ultimately, it's not, I think, about the budget plan of next year. It is about the broader political dynamics in Italy and the EU.
I would agree with that. I think that what is at stake from the side of the Commission is the credibility of the entire fiscal machinery, which is not very strong. I would not say it's a zero either. But if the Commission would just condone what the Italian government is doing, the credibility would be brought down to zero. So I don't think they can afford that either economically or politically.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, both Alex and Francesco. Unfortunately, we have to close things up. It's fascinating really talking with you about these. You've wonderfully set out all the different considerations that we have at the moment. So thank you very much both for joining us.
If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us a review.